So in my early 20s, I started working for a church. And just out of college, you guys know my story. The Lord grabbed a hold of me in college. And then coming out of college, I actually was hired on staff in the campus ministry that I was a part of. And so in my early 20s, I lived in houses with lots of young men, in these discipleship houses that that our church actually initiated, and I led it. And the guys that I lived with were incredibly creative young men. And we found, Kemp said, you know, we like to get down here, we like to have a good time. Like, living with the guys that I lived with, we would always find ways to have a good time. And anytime they came up with an idea, because I was like their discipleship director, anything they came up with that was somewhat legal, I felt obligated and compelled to join them in. I just had to go along with it because we were forming a community together. And so it was Halloween many years ago in my early 20s. It was a Halloween weekend. And one of the guys that I lived with came up to me and said, "Hey, Brian, we're doing something tonight and you've got to join us." And I'm like, "Okay, cool." Like, I was familiar with this. I said, "Tell me what we're doing." And he said, "Well, here's what's going on. Tonight, we're going to have a Jack Me Up O-Lantern Festival." And you guys, everybody know what a Jack O-Lantern is? Where you take a pumpkin and you carve it and you turn it into something cool or scary, whatever. Everybody knows what a Jack O-Lantern is. Well, for whatever reason, one of the guys that I lived with was going through a breakup. And his heart was broken. And his idea was, let's do this. Let's get everybody in the house. We're going to get a big pumpkin. And everybody's going to write on the pumpkin the names of the young ladies who broke their heart. And this, so this, we're going to litter this pumpkin with names of ex-girlfriends. And then what we're going to do is we're going to climb a building on campus at Akron U. And I debated whether I should tell you the name of the building or not, because I don't want anybody to do this. But it was Schrank Hall South. Don't do it. We're going to climb Schrank Hall South, which is not easy to climb, and it's illegal. But anyway, we're going to climb it, and then we're going to take this pumpkin, and we're going to drop it off of the 6 to 7 story building under the parking lot, and we're going to just watch the names of all of our girlfriends go to oblivion, the ones that hurt us. And so I said, "All right, cool, I'm in." And so the Jack Me Up O-Lantern Festival was on. So we got the pumpkin. Everybody wrote the names of the young ladies that hurt them on there. I wrote one, high school flame. I'm not going to say her name because we podcast this. I don't want her to feel bad. But I wrote a name on there. And then we did. We walked over to the building under the cover of night, and Schrank Hall South, there's like a facade wall, and then inside the facade there's like the real wall, but you can like climb up it. Since I actually climbed it twice, after the second time I climbed it, they actually cemented it so you can no longer do this because the police caught us the second time. That's a different story, but the Jack Me Up O-Lantern story is, so we climbed to the top, we have this pumpkin, and it was like this weird little, like, humans are good at coming up with like religious things, ceremonies, whatever. And so we stood up there, everybody like put their hand on the pumpkin, like as a symbol of the name, like, "Hey, our heart's broke and this is the thing." And then we just launched this pumpkin over the, I don't know if it's 6 or 7 stories, but the pumpkin then just started like careening down to the ground at a great speed. Did not have sufficient time to reach terminal velocity, which I think is like 220 miles per hour. It wasn't that high of a building, but it was high enough that when the pumpkin hit the parking lot, that sucker just spread out. It was just a pumpkin bomb went off. And we all kind of felt better after that. I don't know what it is, but there's something inside of us as human beings that we are compelled to take abstract concepts and to make them concrete. To take something that's ethereal and to make it visual and tactile. And so the psychologists in the room could maybe explain why a communal setting where like me and the guys together doing this thing that was very visual and very loud when the pumpkin smacked, that there, in all of this, there might be some cathartic healing regarding past wounds in this ceremony. I don't know, but whatever is meaningful to us, we tend to want to and have to make it concrete, make it real. Like just yesterday, I was at two different ceremonies. One was a graduation ceremony. And in the graduation ceremony, they do things like move your tassel from the one side of your hat to the other. And then they say, now I confer on you the degree upon which you blah, blah, blah. And then they lead you in this, like this very ceremonial sort of a thing. And so the idea is, I was a student, now I'm a graduate. And we ask the question, like, when did that happen? Well, we create the ceremony so that our minds and our hearts know that's done. Now I am a graduate. I am a doctor. I am a whoever. And that we actually also do the same thing when we marry somebody, right? I guess theoretically you could just kind of maybe young men walk up to a young woman and say, you want to be married to me? And she could say yes. And then you're like, okay, cool. High five. Let's go live as married, right? But that's too abstract. It's too ethereal. It's too like, we need to do something to concrete the fact that we were not married. Now we are. And so what we do is a ceremony. And in the ceremony, we just did a recommittal yesterday for one of my favorite couples. But there's a point where we put rings on each other's finger. And we talk about marriage and we talk about commitment. And after the rings go on the finger, then someone will say, I declare now that you are husband and wife. And then you may kiss the bride, a very tactical, tactile, concrete experience. And then they turn and you present them to their family and friends and they walk out. And somewhere in there, our minds and our hearts accommodate to the reality that before we walked in here, we were not married. Now that we've gone through this ceremony and we've concreted it with real, tangible, visible things, we walk out of here and we are married, so let's make this thing work. Now, with that said, our need to visualize and to see abstract, ethereal things and to make them real and personal, to make them hit. God knows this because He made us. And so one of the things that God is really intent on us catching is that He is the one who takes away our sin. Okay? Now, regarding that idea, that is very abstract and it is very ethereal. Okay, God, cool. You want to take away my sin. I like that. I agree with that. And then here's what God does with His people to make it land in our hearts and in our minds. Old Testament. What God would have His people do is He would have them offer sacrifices. And a sacrifice is the same thing as putting a ring on the finger of your spouse. It's like moving the tassel across your hat. But a sacrifice was where God would command His people Israel to take animals and like in front of them, as they're in proximal distance to the animal, the priest would literally kill the animal. That a blade would go in and blood would flow out, and with the blood flowing out of the animal, the life would come out of the animal. And the idea is that your sin demands your life. Because we are in rebellion against God, we should be alienated and far from Him. But then God says, no, I don't want you to be alienated and far. I want you to be close and near, sons and daughters in my family. So we have to deal with your sin. And so how we're going to deal with it is we're going to take the sin that is on you, and we're going to stick it on this animal. And the punishment that was on you now goes to the animal. And so what happens is the animal has to lose its life. And the Hebrew people were literally in present proximity of animals losing their lives regularly so that they could be reminded of the concrete reality, or to be concretely reminded of the reality that God is the one who takes away sin. So every day in the temple, sacrifices are being offered. Every week, a different rhythm of sacrifices. Monthly, another rhythm of sacrifices. And then yearly, with the festivals that God commanded His people to celebrate, like we have Thanksgiving and Christmas, He had festivals for them. There were different sacrifices to be offered so that they could be regularly and rhythmically reminded that God is the one who takes away our sin. He takes it off of us and He puts it somewhere else. Like on the Day of Atonement, another tactile, visual demonstration of this that God gave us so that we would remember that He's the one that takes it. Day of Atonement, there's lots of things that happen, but one thing is that they would take this goat, and they called the goat the scapegoat. And the high priest would stand in front of the scapegoat and symbolically lay his hand on the goat's head. This is in Leviticus. You can read it. And the high priest would do this. And what would happen is, like, symbolically, that the sins of the entire nation of Israel, of which the high priest is their representative, as he puts his hand on the head of the goat, the sins of the people leave the people, go through the priest onto the goat. Which is pretty awesome. If you don't want to walk in your sin and the consequences of it and all the things that come with being a sin bearer, the next best, like the coolest thing is to have another sin bearer that's not you who would carry your sin. And then after the sin would transfer from the people through the high priest to the scapegoat, then what they would do is they would smack the goat on the butt or whatever you do to get the goat moving, and then the goat would move on out into the wilderness. And who's there watching? All the people who are sinners, who know they're sinners. They just jacked everything up yesterday. They just transgressed last week. We all know who we are. But here's God's goodness. Your sin that you walked in, you are not bearing that anymore. The high priest laid that on the goat, and then where's the goat go? Away, gone. Like into the wilderness abyss, the goat has left the building. And so God, in his grace, wants to take away our sin. And God, in his wisdom and kindness, knows that we need to be regularly reminded that he is the one who takes away sin. And so he gives us very concrete reminders in the Old Testament that they would regularly and rhythmically celebrate to continue to remind them that God is the one who takes away their sin. Now, that's awesome for Old Testament Hebrews, that they had this tactile, tangible, concrete experience where they were reminded that God is the one that takes away sin. But we don't get to offer sacrifices anymore. Good for them, bad for us. Because we also need concrete reminders of abstract truths. Well, Jesus knew this. And so Jesus then goes to the cross, and all of the Old Testament tangible and tactile pictures that remind us that God is going to be the one who takes away our sin. Jesus then goes to the cross as the one to whom all of those other pictures were pointing. The New Testament writers say the blood of goats and bulls can't take away sin. The scapegoat didn't really, in an ontological way, take our sin out of the camp. But what that was pointing to is that God would provide a future grace that actually would accomplish all of the things that these sacrifices and festivals pointed to. And then Jesus in himself bears the sin of all who believe. But right before Jesus bore our sin, what he did is he had a final supper with his closest disciples. And at the end of the supper, they're still confused about where this whole story is going. His disciples don't know that the cross is coming, even though Jesus has told them. They can't get it in their circuitry that the Messiah has to die. That's not in their story narrative, according to how they want things to go. But Jesus is faithful to explain to them things to come anyway. And Jesus says again, guys, I am going to die. And after I do, and then when I rise, it's all going to make sense. But just trust me here, that here's what I want you and all of my followers to do for the rest of time until I return. And then what he does is he gets very concrete and tactile. And he takes a loaf of bread and he breaks it. And he says, guys and gals, this bread, and then you can hear it in the room, the breaking of the bread. He said, this is a symbol of my soon-to-be-broken body. And then he passes the bread out piece by piece, rip by rip, piece of bread by piece of bread. And then tactically, everyone in the room grabs a piece of bread. And then they eat. And then he says, And then he takes the fruit of the vine and he pours it into a glass. And he says, in this, like, my body is broken. The bread is a picture of that for you. this fruit of the vine is a symbol, and you can even see in its coloring, it is a symbol of my blood that's about to be poured out. And then he passed it around and everybody drank. And then Jesus said, guys, regularly and often, as you gather together, you need to take bread and you need to break it. And you need to take the fruit of the vine and you need to pour it. Because what you need is the same thing that my Old Testament people needed. They needed a regular and rhythmic and very concrete reminder that I am the one who makes a provision for your sin. I am the one who covers your rebellion. I am the one who bears in myself the consequences and condemnation that in our lives we earned and we deserve. And I need you to remember that, because if you stop remembering that, you're going to do what Adam and Eve did in Genesis 3. In their sin, they hid from me. And we can't have that anymore. In your sin, I need you to run to me. And so we're going to gather together and we're going to be reminded. And so think of it this way. In the Old Testament, God gave his people very tactical and tangible and concrete pictures of the one who was to come in the future, so that they could know that God is the one who makes provision for sin. And then Jesus comes as the fulfillment of all of those Old Testament pictures. They look forward to the cross with their ceremonies. And as we, after Jesus, take the bread and the cup, what we do is we're reminded to look back upon the one whom the bread and the cup represent, who bore our sin and our shame and our guilt. And so this morning, we're going to get tactile. We're going to get concrete. And we're going to take the bread and we're going to take the cup. Because Jesus was right. We need reminded that he is the sin bearer. Because if we're not reminded of that, we will think that we are the sin bearer. And if we think we are the sin bearer, then we will run from him and not to him. And God said, I don't want that. I need you to run to me. So be reminded. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do communion a little bit differently this morning than we normally do. I'm just going to give you the instructions. We're going to have our worship team come up. Actually, maybe just Jasmine and Lizzie. Maybe just the two of you. Yeah, I think. Okay. We're going to have a worship song. They're going to lead us in song. And as soon as I come down, we're just going to get up and we're going to kind of exit out the sides here. We're going to come across the front. And there's the bread. There it is. Right, just had this image of like the bread breaking. We're not breaking it. It's already been broken. But when you come up here, just pretend that it's a loaf and you're like ripping it and you can hear it, right? Because Jesus was, he was ripped. And then take the cup, right? And just pretend that Jesus is there like pouring it out and you can hear it and you can see it, because that's what he did. And he wants us to be reminded of that. And then go back to your seat, and then we're going to sing the worship song together. We're going to join in. And then instead of you taking it on your own, I'm going to come back up at the end of the song, and I'm going to lead us, and we're going to take it together so that we can have a communal, tactile experience to remind us that God loves us, that he is the one who has chosen joyfully to bear our sin, and who is kind enough to command us to regularly remember this so that we can run to him and not run away from him. Are we good? Can we do that? If you are here and you are exploring Jesus, we are so pumped that you are here. We want you to be here as long as you need to work through whatever it is that you need to work through. We'd love to talk with you about whatever it is that you're working through on your journey to Jesus. But just know that this is not any kind of magical incantation. If you are not like in faith, trusting in Jesus as your deliverer, this is your invitation to watch. This is something that God gives those who have received the gift of Jesus' body broken and blood poured. And if that's not you, we're so pumped that you're here, but just invite you to watch. And don't feel bad about not getting up. We're so pumped that you're here. Okay. So you guys take it away. We're going to start moving now. We're going to come across, get the elements, take it back. Do not eat it until I come back up. Good. All right, let's do it. I told you this morning was going to be tactile. and tangible. And communion is clearly both of those. But we're also going to celebrate baptism here in just a bit. And baptism is tactile and tangible and concrete. Here's the context. Baptism in the New Testament, the phraseology is that we go, quote, through the waters of baptism. And if you're not careful, you'll miss the deep, resonant undertones of what it means to go through the waters. To go through the waters actually goes all the way back to the beginning in creation itself, when what we know of as planet Earth was a watery abyss. And what happened is that God brought dry land through the waters. In the progression of creation itself that is now, we see it as an incredible gift. The land had to come through the waters in order to move forward into a fruitful future. Regarding creation, before a baby can be born into the world, the baby must first, in the creation motif of through the waters, the waters must break, and the baby must go through to enter into a new place, a new reality. Anytime we see God bringing people through the waters, you are leaving one reality and you are stepping into a whole new one. And the whole new reality that he's bringing you into is so much better than the one from which you left. The iconic story of moving through the waters is the book of Exodus, when God's people are in a particular reality. And the reality they're in is called slavery in Egypt. They're in the land of bondage. And then you know the story, through 10 plagues, God releases the grip of Pharaoh on his people, and his people get up on out of their houses and they start moving away from Egypt. But then they come to this epic of all barriers, which is a literal sea of water. And they get to the edge of the sea, and there's clearly no way through it. There's no ferry service. There's no barges that we can hire. There's no cruise ships that would come and take us on the journey. It's just us on land, and then there's water. And then Pharaoh, as he often did, changed his mind and said, no, I can't let them go. I need them. And he comes after them with the strongest army that the world had seen up until that point. And God's people are in a bit of a pinch. And it looks as if, on paper, if you were in Vegas giving betting odds, well, the Egyptians are going to come grab you, and they're going to take you back to the old reality. The only reality that these people knew, which was bondage and slavery. But that's where God got very tactile, and he got very concrete. And he sent this wind. It was a supernatural wind. No earthly wind could have done it. And then he parted the waters. A wall of water on one side and a wall of water on the others. And then Moses says, come on, gang, let's do this. And by faith, they start marching through the waters. And it was quite a journey to make it through. And then they get to the other side. And then in God's kindness, because he knows we need things concreted and we need them to be tactile, because abstract and ethereal somehow get lost on us. When they got to the other side of the sea, God caused the waters to go back to where they were. And so they had a very concrete experience of this. We used to be slaves in Egypt. Now we have gone through the waters, and the waters have come back to their place. We cannot go back there. Remember, there's no ferry service. There's no barge schedule. There is no way for us to go back. And in coming through the waters, what God says is, I have brought you to a whole new place. You used to be slaves, and now you are free. That's quite a reality shift, is it not? And God is the one who does it. And then 40 years later, should have been 10 days later, but we are who we are. 40 years later, God's people who were free and in the wilderness, now it's time to move them into the promised land. In the wilderness and the promised land are two very different realities. And so what God does is he takes them to the edge of the promised land, but the promised land, before they can get in, there's this little barrier there, and it's called water. And it's not the Red Sea, but it is the Jordan River at flood stage. And you don't want to mess with the Jordan River at flood stage. And the waters are moving, and God says, hey, priests, go grab the ark. You're going to lead the charge, and I want you to step up to the waters, and I want you to step into the waters, because my goal is to take you through the waters. But there's no ferry service, there's no bridge, there's no barge service to get across. But as soon as the priests step foot in the waters by faith, the Lord does the same thing that he did a generation ago, and he parts the river. And then his people, Israel, go through the waters, same New Testament language, but as an Old Testament picture, they go through the waters. And then they get to the other side, and variations on a theme, what happens to the Jordan River as soon as they make it to the other side? Well, the waters start flowing again. And the idea is that now you're in a new reality. You went from slavery to freedom through the waters, but now you went from freedom to flourishing through the waters. Because remember, the wilderness is a different place to exist, different than the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Through the waters. And now on this side of the Jordan River, the picture is we are not going back. We can't go back. We can only go this way and follow God into the reality that is flourishing. So in the Old Testament, to go through the waters is to go from slavery to freedom, and then to go through the waters is to go from freedom to flourishing. And he gave them that very real tactile experience of moving forward and the waters not allowing them to go back. They had to stay in the good place that he was leading them into. Well, good for Israel that they had that tactile experience, but we don't have any such experience like that. Oh no, wait, we do. Because when Jesus came on the scene, and God had providentially planned this, the image that was associated with becoming a follower of Jesus became, and actually, like, even before Jesus literally starts his earthly ministry, the Father prompted John the Baptist to make baptism the picture that you were in a land of slavery and bondage to sin and dysfunction and brokenness and all manner of patterns and rhythms of breaking, that was our reality. And then when we get to the humble place where we just can say, yes, God, what God does is he takes us through the waters, from bondage to freedom. But not just from bondage to freedom. He puts the two water images together, from bondage to freedom and from freedom to flourishing. And John the Baptist is baptizing anybody who is willing. And then Jesus himself submits to it and then launches his ministry. And then after Jesus is resurrected, like the iconic two symbols, tactile, concrete, taking the abstract and making them plain and obvious, is communion, which we already celebrated, and then baptism. Communion is the thing that we do regularly and rhythmically to be reminded that God is the one who takes sin in Jesus. Baptism is the reminder that we used to be and now we are, because God has made a way through the waters. And so when we go down into waters, this isn't something that man made up. This isn't a ritual that somebody came up with in the 3rd century or in the medieval church or in the whenever. This goes back to the beginning, and it has its rootedness all the way back to Genesis chapter 1. That God wants and longs for his people to move forward from and to. But we got to go through the waters. And he is the only one who can make a way through the waters. You and I can't make it through the Red Sea, neither could Israel. We can't make it through the Jordan River at flood stage, neither could Israel. No, nobody can do that. Only God can do that. And so this morning, we're going to celebrate with some of our friends here that in Jesus, that they have gone from slavery to freedom and from freedom to flourishing, that God has changed their reality. And we're told as human beings not to mix our metaphors, because things get complicated. But God is quite happy to mix his metaphors, Because baptism is a picture of going through the waters from one reality, the old, into the new, and God makes a way. But baptism is also, like, God shows us very specifically, and he makes this connection in the New Testament letters for us, that in Jesus' death, Jesus goes into the grave. And going into the waters is the picture of us being in Christ with him going into the grave. And it's in the grave that Jesus, like in the cross and in the grave, Jesus deals with our sin. And then in the grave, Jesus actually confronts death on our behalf. And then Jesus conquers death. So we go down into the grave with Jesus, but we don't stay there because Jesus didn't stay there. What does he do? He brings us back up through the waters. And now our sin has been dealt with through the waters, and death on our behalf has been dealt with through the waters, and it's a move through the waters into new life in the Spirit with God, always, always moving forward into flourishing, because that's our new reality as sons and daughters of the great High King, who only knows how to lead us to good places. And so we're going to celebrate that this morning. We're going to hear some testimonies here. And testimonies are just, it's just someone's concrete story of what God has done to move them from the old into the new, and them becoming aware that Jesus is the one who does that. And there's no testimony that is uncool. There is no testimony that is not radically powerful, because God is the one who has been operative behind that story. And so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to invite up, I got my notes here, and I think my notes are right. But so we've got some people who are going to get baptized who are going to have somebody reading for them. It's their testimony, but it's not them. And so if I'm correct, we've got Autumn Brown who's going to get baptized. And then Jasmine is going to read that story. Is that correct? Jasmine, you good? You good with Autumn? Okay, come on up. Jasmine, representing Autumn's story. Let's hear it.
This is Autumn's story. She says, growing up, I did not know the Lord or much about religion at all, but I was curious and had questions about life and who God was. I viewed God as a judge high up in the sky watching down on us, and it scared me. I met Jesus my junior year of high school through Young Life. A friend of mine invited me to Young Life, and since my first time going, it sparked a curiosity and desire in my heart to know the Lord and understand what living a life following Christ is like. I learned that I was loved and sought out for by God, and the image I had painted of God was in my head, and it began to change. Since then, I've been surrounded by a community of people who love the Lord and encourage me to strengthen my relationship with Jesus every day. My friendships are rooted in Christ, and I know that I am deeply loved and cared for. Today, I'm ready to take the next steps and profess my love for Jesus.
Okay, next up, Paige, you. And my notes say that sister is going to read testimony. Is that true? Okay, come on up, sister. Let's hear it.
This is Paige's story. She says, my family grew up in the church, but looking back, I never had a real relationship with God. We continued going to church, but completely stopped when COVID hit. At this time, I was a freshman in high school, and my athletic career began to take off. In addition to athletics, I found that I had also idolized academics and extracurricular activities, which led to putting God on the back burner. I put my identity in these things all throughout high school, and after multiple injuries and graduating to college, I questioned what my identity was. My senior year of high school, my sister began attending Garden City because her now fiancé invited her. I started going with her, and for the first time, I saw a tight-knit church community with people that were around my age. This experience grew as I began attending H2O Church at BGSU. I was able to grow my community and, more importantly, my relationship with God. For the first time in my life, I was surrounded by people who hungered for a relationship with God. In the beginning of my spiritual journey, I knew God, but I only felt his presence when I wanted to. Since giving my life to him, I see him everywhere, and I find myself inviting him in everywhere, even places that I'm ashamed of. My life has grown brighter, and I have found that I have become more bold in my faith. I have learned that getting baptized is an outward sign of an inward change, and I want to declare my devotion to God and proclaim my love for Him.
Awesome. All right, next up, Lexi Dunn. I believe Lexi is reading her own. All right, here comes Lexi.
Hello, my name is Lexi, and I'm going to try to keep this short and sweet since we are blessed to have so many baptisms today. So I grew up in a very loving home with a lot of Christian morals, but I only really went to church on holidays. I was always very fond of the Christian atmosphere, but knew very little to nothing about God. I first learned about Christianity in fifth grade when a close friend started bringing me to her church's youth group. But I didn't start to develop an intimate relationship with God until I began Young Life my sophomore year of high school. Since giving my life to God, I have noticed significant changes in my priorities, perspective, and attitude. I no longer find my identity in grades, sports, or relationship with others, but understand that my identity is found in Him. I am so excited to be getting baptized today, and I look forward to continuing to strengthen my relationship with the Lord. I cannot wait to see what He has planned for me.
All right, next up, Gwendolyn Anderson, also read by Jasmine.
This is Gwen's story. She says, my life before having a true relationship with Jesus was filled with anger, depression, and anxiety. I was unable to forgive my father for the abuse he gave my mom and for allowing us to go through it and still stay. I was quick to anger and would always have lash outs and was never truly happy. I was stressed out every day of my life due to worldly things like money, time, school, etc. I was never able to snap myself out of the depression and negative thoughts that filled my brain. I grew up in a Catholic church and always went to church and prayed. I always knew who Jesus was, but I never truly had a relationship with Him until I started going to Garden City. I was always filled with fear that one wrong sin would happen and I was going to hell. My first time coming to Garden City, the worship filled me with tears, and I could truly feel Jesus pouring His love through me. When Pastor Brian spoke, my attention was fully on Him, and I knew that this was where I needed to be. Since giving my life to Jesus, I am happier, no more depression or anxiety. I no longer stress about the little things, or when I do, I catch myself and I pray to God and it goes away. I listen to worship music and it fills my soul with the presence of the Holy Spirit, and I never miss church anymore. I used to never go to church when I was still Catholic, and now I look forward to Sunday worship and I love going. I also started reading my Bible. I think about God every single day and incorporate Him into every aspect of my life now. I'm no longer quick to anger or quick to gossip or quick to judge. I'm trying to love others, including my enemies, like Jesus, and I pray that everyone gets to experience this peace and love one day themselves.
Amen. All right, Chessa Homan, I believe, reading her own story. Chessa, all right, come on up.
Hi, I'm Chessa. So I grew up in a Christian home and I had amazing people, examples of people who love Jesus and my parents and my siblings. When I was 12, I decided I wanted to get baptized because that's what I was supposed to do. My dad even sat me down and talked me through it because he wanted me to get it. Me being the independent and stubborn kid I was, I decided I was going to do it no matter what because I thought I had to. I believed that God was real and that Jesus died on the cross, but as I got into middle school and high school, I realized I did not have a personal relationship with Him. My freshman year of high school, I started going to Young Life, and when I talked to my leader about it, she said it sounded like I did not want to give up my control, and she was correct. I struggled with the idea of giving God control because I didn't feel like He even cared about me. At the end of my freshman year, COVID happened, and I lost every bit of control I tried to keep over my life. One day, I was sitting on the floor in my bathroom crying, and I said to God that I was done trying. I gave up on Him because I was so sure He never cared about me. For the next two-ish years, I struggled a lot. I searched for validation from people and struggled with my self-worth. I was angry at everyone, including myself, and hated hearing stories about people's relationship with Jesus because it felt unfair. My life was ruled by my anxiety, anger, and need for control. Like I mentioned before, during all of this, I was attending Young Life. Even though I was angry at God, I still went because it was where my friends were, and the leaders cared about me, even though I was an angsty teenager. I was checked out for most of my sophomore year, and I was in a very low place. The summer after that year, I went to camp and heard one of my leaders give his testimony. It was one of the first times I remember actively listening in a long time. I still was not ready to give up control, but when a bunch of my friends gave their lives to Jesus at the end of the week, I was not angry or jealous, but for the first time, I was so excited for them. Only a few months later, at Young Life, my leader read Psalms 23:4. Even when I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. In that moment, I realized that I was wrong about God not caring about me, but it was me who was face down on the ground, mad that God was not there, when in reality, he was standing above me with his hand stretched out, asking me to get up and walk with him. The next day, we left and went on a trip with Young Life where I got to sit alone for 20 minutes to talk to God. In that time, I felt the most overwhelming sense of peace, and God telling me that I did not need validation from others because the God of the universe calls me daughter, and that is all that mattered. That is when I gave my life to Jesus. After this, I still struggled with anxiety and control, but walking with Christ made it easier. Going into my senior year, I had a whole plan for my life. I was so sure my plan was the greatest, but it was still easy for me to let things distract me from God. I went to my last year of Young Life camp where I felt God calling me to lead Young Life, which I never thought I would do, and was upset I would not be able to lead where I was going to school. When I started college a few weeks later, after a few days, I realized that I was not able to love people well where I was. I felt God telling me I was not where I was supposed to be, so after 2 weeks, I dropped out and transferred to Akron for the next semester, which if you know me, was something I swore I would never do, and admitting I was wrong is also really hard for me. It felt like my life was falling apart, and I had never been more out of control, but I felt completely at peace knowing God was in control and that his plan was better. Since that day, my relationship with God has only grown, and I found my home in Akron, got placed as a Young Life leader, and found the best community. Giving up my control to God was the best decision of my life. I'm getting baptized to say that I'm not in control. God is, and I'm so grateful for that.
Thanks, Chessa. All right, Kaya Roldan. Where's Kaya? All right, come on up.
It's so much different looking at you guys and just looking at Brian up here. Okay. My life before Jesus was lonely and full of worry. I was constantly second-guessing my purpose, how I was perceived, if I was enough, why I wasn't enough for certain people, and how I was going to make it through a lifetime of feeling this way, yet knowing that there was no way that we were made to spend a lifetime feeling this way. Jesus has always been a part of my life in some way. I went to church when I was little, church camps throughout the summer, youth group in middle school, etc. And I feel like we've had a lifetime of knowing each other, but it wasn't until a year ago that I truly felt a relationship with Jesus, one where I go to him as a father and as a friend. How has my life changed since giving my life to him? True peace. My circumstances aren't necessarily different, but the level of peace I feel through the same amount of chaos is unreal. The peace I experienced through a relationship with him has created so much clarity where I was once so confused. And not because he's given me all of the answers, but because I've seen him show up in ways that I can now trust and relax that even when I don't have any of the answers, I know he's constantly working behind the scenes in my favor. I've never felt so worthy, so loved, protected, and yet so humbled all at the same time. I've realized there were so many things in my life that I was never meant to carry or walk through alone, and I felt too ashamed asking for help or feeling like I was an inconvenience to people. But 24/7 access to the one who never gets tired of listening to me cry, never gets tired of wiping my tears, and isn't sleeping when I need to call him at 3 a.m. That free and never-ending access to the creator of the universe, that has changed my life.
Thank you. So good. All right, last one. Brian Faulkner, come on up. Brian, where you at? There he is. All right. Worship band, why don't you guys come on up and go ahead and get ready. You can head up and get all set. So, Brian, this is not your first time going through the waters.
Don't really recall the first.
You're a little too young for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so baptized as a baby. You didn't really have any participation in that. I mean, the water sprinkled on your forehead probably. But you're here making a decision today.
A conscious decision, yes.
Yeah. anything that you want us to know about you and Jesus and what he's doing in you.
I've been going through it lately. There have been some fantastic works taking place in my life. I just, after decades of skepticism and, you know, being the last person you'd ever expect to talk about miracles, it's become increasingly difficult for me to remain skeptical. And so here I am, accepting, happy, and for the first time in a long time, not terrified.
You've got a father that loves you. Man, thank you, Brian. All right, let's do this. Everybody that's getting baptized, just kind of come sit up here in the front row somewhere. And here's how we do baptisms here. We love to sing worship songs while we're doing baptisms. And so we're just, because essentially we're just celebrating God and who he is, but also what he's doing among us. Yeah. So we're going to sing, and we're going to go through the waters, because God's good like that. And you have permission, you don't have to, but as we're singing, if someone goes down and comes up like through the waters, you're free to stop singing and just yell or scream or woohoo, anything like that. You can also keep singing, you can stay silent, whatever you want to do, you can do. There's freedom in the house, but it's worth celebrating. All right, so you guys start leading us, and then we'll just start moving through the waters.